Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, December 26, 2014. Sudan decides to expel two senior UN officials from the country.
Any UN official that dares to stand up for those principles for which they are placed there is bound to incur the wrath of the Sudan government.
And government officials in Juba once again call on displaced Bor residents to return home.
People at the grassroots to relate to each other, to have peace among themselves, to be engaged in the dialogue, try to reconcile. If they don't, then the peace in Addis Ababa will be meaningless.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. But we first go to Sudan. Sudan has ordered two top UN officials to leave the country. Late last month, Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir said a UN peacekeepers should prepare an exit strategy after reports surfaced that Sudanese soldiers were involved in a mass rape in Darfur. UN spokesman Stephanie Dujarric tells South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme that the sanctioning of UN personnel in Sudan is unacceptable.
The sanctioning of UN personnel and the order to expel them is unacceptable. These two senior UN officials were sent to Sudan to carry out their duties in accordance with the United Nations Charter. From our standpoint, we condemn the decision and we call on the government to reverse it.
Is this even legal? Can they take this action and forcibly expel these two officials?
Any government has the sovereign right to do this. And if the order goes through and is not reversed, these two people will obviously have to leave Sudan. But it is something that we are calling on for the government to reverse, to reconsider, and to cooperate fully with all UN entities are currently working in Sudan.
As you know, Sudanese soldiers in Tabit, a village in Darfur, were accused of mass rape not that long ago, and the United Nations staff there in Sudan were trying to conduct their own investigation. Do you believe this has something to do with that?
I think you would have to ask the Sudanese as to what is government, as to what you would have to ask the Sudanese government as to what is motivating them to act in this way and to enact these decisions. We are continuing, our peacekeeping mission is continuing to try to gain access to that town. The issue of the freedom of movement of peacekeeping personnel of the joint mission has been an issue recently and continues to be an issue recently, and we expect from the Sudanese authorities full freedom of movement for our peacekeeping personnel.
Late last month, I was able to speak to the Sudanese ambassador to the United Nations, and he was very strong in his opinion that these soldiers did not take part in the alleged mass rape, and that he claims the United Nations personnel that are already in Sudan were given access to this village. However, they were accompanied by the very same Sudanese soldiers that were accused of this rape. Is that your recollection of events?
It is my understanding that there was some very initial contact in the town, but what we are asking for is for full unfettered access, both peacekeeping and other UN personnel, to be able to assess what actually happened, because obviously allegations of rape are very serious, and we take them very seriously, and we need to investigate them.
And so far, just to set the record straight, the UN personnel have not been able to get back to that village.
No, they have not been able to.
For an independent investigation.
That's correct.
Where do things stand now? Does that mean that all the UN personnel have to leave Sudan?
No, this is and first of all, I think we need to understand these are two separate entities. You have, on one hand, UNAMID, which is the joint UN-AU peacekeeping mission, which works in Darfur. The two senior UN officials, the resident coordinator and the country director for the UNDP, are based in Khartoum and are completely separate from the peacekeeping mission. These are UN people who work and operate.
Right, namely Ali Al-Zatari, the UN resident coordinator of the UN Development Program, and Yvonne Hell, UNDP's country director.
Exactly. Now, obviously, you know, there is a strategic review ongoing of the UN peacekeeping mission in Darfur, which will be delivered to the Security Council in February. As part of the mandated review by the Security Council, we are looking at exit strategy options for the mission. But as you know, the presence of a peacekeeping mission, of any UN peacekeeping mission, is decided upon by the Security Council, and we operate under a mandate granted to us by the Security Council.
Stephanie Dujarric is the UN spokesperson in New York. He was speaking to South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam. Eric Cohen is the co-founder of Act for Sudan, a group against genocide. He says Sudan's decision to expel UN coordinators is in direct response to the UN effort to conduct an independent investigation of the alleged mass rape in Darfur.
It's a dramatic illustration that returning to villages that Darfuris had been driven out of earlier is still far from safe. And it's also a dramatic illustration that the government of Sudan, which has created so much of this physical insecurity, is moving in the wrong direction, seeking to kick the UNAMID protective forces out of Darfur at the same time when they're needed more than ever. We've seen reports of escalating violence throughout the regions of Darfur, and it's scary to think that those levels of violence have returned to the levels that were the worst levels at the height of the genocide in 2003-2004. And with those kind of levels of violence, the government should be seeking by every method to be protecting the people rather than kicking UNAMID out and letting tribes run rampant.
If these people were simply villagers trying to return home, they were not in any way, shape, or form seeming to be any kind of militia group, why would they be gunned down like this?
The reports that I've heard are that this is attacks from tribes that did not want the people to be returning to their villages. And the people who they murdered were actually elders and imams from a nearby village who had gone to Amada to pray and welcome IDPs home. And this is the welcome they've received from their neighboring tribes. This is, I think, if the reports can be confirmed, an example of the results of the government policy of resettling other tribes on the land and in the villages where Darfuris had been driven out of.
What can be done in these areas, which sound very remote, to try to protect these people who are trying to return home?
Darfur is a very large place, but we have to start building security for the people there and making efforts to disarm the Janjaweed and the government-aligned militias is a start, and having UNAMID playing an aggressive and active role in protecting wherever they can is a start. But without those beginnings, what we see is the degeneration of violence everywhere.
I understand that the governor of South Darfur State, Adam Mahmoud Jar al-Nabi, I believe that's how you pronounce it, declared an indefinite emergency situation in South Darfur State, including a curfew. Does that help any?
I don't think so. I think he's protecting his interests in the cities.
When you say protecting his interests, what do you mean?
The government's interests in maintaining control in the large cities and supporting the tribes. Remember that the Janjaweed are supplied both by money and arms and protection from the government. And this has left the pro-government aligned tribes awash in weapons and able to commit attacks such as these.
What about the special tribunals that are supposedly set up to investigate crimes? Are they doing anything?
The special tribunals are years old, and they are widely recognized as the joke that they are. There have been men of some integrity who have been assigned to lead those tribunals, and they subsequently quit in protest because they could accomplish nothing. They could not investigate or bring cases. It's the entire effort from the government in this area is a stalling tactic that only fools in the West would accept as being a sincere effort to bring justice for the perpetrators of such violence.
That's Eric Cohen, a co-founder of Act for Sudan, speaking to Carol Van Dam this past hour from New Hampshire. Mukesh Kapila was the United Nations resident coordinator in Sudan in 2003. He says the government of Sudan has never been friendly to UN diplomats critical of the conflict in Darfur and human rights abuses committed by a government proxy army fighting along Sudan armed forces in Western Sudan, Southern Kordofan and Blue Nile State. He says the international community is not doing enough to hold Sudan accountable for violating international treaties.
The UN is there in Sudan to provide the implementation of certain international principles to which Sudan itself has signed up. And this includes protection of its own civilians, the provision of humanitarian aid, the assistance for the development of the country, and in fostering the international rule of law. So any UN official that dares to stand up for those principles for which they are placed there is bound to incur the wrath of the Sudan government. And there is a long line of such officials. And when I got turned away 10 years ago this year, it was for that reason, because I stood up against the government of Sudan for the genocidal crimes that they were committing in Darfur.
When you were asked to leave the country, what was the initial reaction of the international community, and for that matter, the United Nations?
Today's United Nations is better than the United Nations that I knew. For example, the current Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, has made a robust statement protesting at the expulsion of the UN staff. When I got into trouble with the Sudanese government for being outspoken, basically I had no support from the UN administration in New York at that time. And it was a failure of leadership at the very top, starting Kofi Annan himself, that led to a climate of appeasement of the Sudanese authorities, which meant that instead of standing up to the early days of the crimes being committed, we basically gave license to the Sudanese authorities to continue committing those crimes because the UN just closed its eyes.
And even as we speak today, the government in Khartoum still has what analysts are calling carte blanche to do what they want to do in Darfur.
Absolutely. In fact, what has happened is that the lip service that has been paid by the international community, including the United Nations political and peacekeeping processes, have simply provided an alibi behind which the government of al-Bashir can continue to commit its crimes. And recently, because the investigations into al-Bashir and his cronies, who have been indicted by the International Criminal Court, have been suspended, this has given even greater empowerment to the regime to be able to continue doing its things. I see the connection between the ICC's suspension of its investigations into the crimes against humanity in Darfur and the recent expulsions of senior UN staff in Khartoum as not unconnected.
10 years ago is a history now, but I still want to pick up your brain on how you managed to work as a diplomat in Khartoum. I remember reading your book, and you were giving instances of how your driver was an agent and how they could send unwanted visitors to come and knock at your door at night or call your number. How did you survive that environment?
It was very difficult. Certainly, living in Khartoum 10 years ago, under the eye of the regime of President Bashir, you had to keep your nerve. You were bugged. Your office was bugged. Your home was bugged. You were surrounded by agents. The UN staff of your country team, they were infiltrated by agents of the regime. Your counterparts in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or in the Humanitarian Ministry were essential proxies for the security services. I decided that I was going to behave in a straightforward manner. I was going to do my duty. I was going to implement the principles of the United Nations Charter without fear or favor to the best of my ability. And my defense mechanism was basically to be consistent in what I was saying and doing. What I said is what I did. And what I did, I talked about. And I said the same thing in front of people as behind their backs. And the government soon realized that I could not be corrupted, that I could not be bought over in a way. Of course, this also infuriated my UN colleagues at that time, many of whom really wanted to have an easy life, not to antagonize the government. But clearly, to be honest with you, I did not necessarily have much support from within the UN system at that moment in time. However, my strategy of coping with the Darfur unfolding and all the other problems that were going on at Sudan at the time, against a backdrop of the Gulf War against Saddam that was also going on in 2003, was simply to stick to principles. And if you stick to your principles, then people may not like what you're doing. They might even scheme against you. They might even send you death threats. But at the very least, you earn a degree of respect and credibility.
That's Mukesh Kapila, a former UN resident coordinator in Sudan. He is currently a special representative of Agis Trust, a civil society working for prevention of crimes against humanity around the world. He also teaches global health and humanitarian affairs at Manchester University. He wrote a book about his experience with the Sudan government entitled Against a Tide of Evil. He was speaking to me from London earlier today. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, why are South Sudanese internally displaced by the conflict, refusing to return home? We have answers after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is it okay for you to use your cell phone if you're engaged in a conversation with someone else already?
No, it's not okay, because that someone, you feel like you're not interested in him or her. You feel like maybe we don't want to be conversating with him or her. So it's not good. That's a bad picture to someone.
I can use your cell phone because you might be at a conversation at the same time doing a business transaction on the cell phone. So it's good to use.
It depends on the gravity of the conversation and the importance of the call.
Depending on the kind of conversation or who calls me on the phone, for example, my fiancé is calling or my dad and I'm expecting money from him, definitely I will excuse you and pick up my call.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. People displaced at the height of the fighting from their homes in Jonglei State are being asked to return home to rebuild their area. Many residents are expressing support for a government appeal for the people to return to their homes. Jacob Achek reports from Bor.
Information and Broadcasting Minister Michael Makuenlues, who hailed from Bor, told a congregation at St. Andrew's Church on Christmas Day to prepare for peace rather than dwell on the suffering they have experienced during the conflict.
I appeal to all the people of Jonglei State, in the displaced camps, in the refugee camps, and in the diaspora. I appeal to them to come back to Bor, come back to their estate, come back to Jonglei, so that we come and start development in our home area.
Makwe told 1,000 gathered at St. Andrew yesterday that even though the peace talk in Ethiopia have collapsed once again, he believes peace is just around the corner. Speaking at the same church, Jonglei State's caretaker governor John Kong Nguyen said state officials will be organizing a peace conference to try to reconcile the state communities divided by the conflict. He acknowledged that some state officials based in Juba went to the peace conference to be held in the national capital rather than in Bor. Nguyen said he believed that the best way to restore peace and reconcile the country is to involve communities at the local level in the search for peace.
There is a question that says that the peace deal was between who and who. Others may say the peace deal is between rebels and the government. But it is not like that we need peace among ourselves.
Bor resident Malual War said the peace talk might end the political disagreement among the leaders. But he said communities at the grassroots level need to discuss how to end their animosity and learn how to peacefully coexist.
The peace talk in Addis Ababa will lead to political settlement, the dispute. But of course we need people at the grassroots to relate to each other, to have peace among themselves, to be engaged in the dialogue, try to reconcile. If they don't, then the peace in Addis Ababa will be meaningless.
Bor resident Maj Achuos is urging the thousands of people sex shelter at UN camp to return to villages and work to restore peace in the state.
The peace at the grassroots is very important in such a way that the coexistence and the trust will be built among us, especially the cohabitants, the inhabitants of Bor. Bor is inhabited by Nuer, Dinka Bor, Murle, Anuak, the Jia. If we make peace here, it will be better than the peace in Addis. The peace in Addis people are going there only to look at their percentages. They don't even mind about the people here. But the people here should look at their own peace.
The latest round of peace talks mediated by the regional bloc's Intergovernmental Authority on Development collapsed last weekend. No date has been set to restart the eagerly talks. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Bor, Jonglei State.
And now some more news from around the continent. Five Amison soldiers and a foreign contractor were killed during a Shabab attack on a base belonging to African Union in Mogadishu on Thursday. Spokesman for the African Union mission in Somalia, Colonel Ali Aden Mahmoud, says the death toll is now 14 people, including civilians. He says the operation to mop up al-Shabaab attackers who penetrated the African Union base in Mogadishu yesterday ended today.
Our operation concluded this morning at about 9 o'clock. We were making some coordinate search around what has happened yesterday. This raid, al-Shabaab fighters has failed as usual, and they lost their lives inside the base camp. And the end of that execution was done this morning at 9. I think civilians and AMISOM at the base camp are all secured, and we think we will have to manage more security inside the base camp and from the outskirts of it.
How many al-Shabaab men were killed and how many may have escaped?
We don't think some of them could have escaped because of the security enforcement we have done after this operation. But we know there were about eight, and eight of them have lost their lives inside the base camp. Next to this operation is how to consolidate security and coordinate between the different entities working inside the base camp of Halani. We need to understand we have a small town within a bigger town of Mogadishu, and that needs a lot of work.
And how many AMISOM troops and civilians were killed in this attack?
At this point, we know three of them lost their lives, and two later after they have been wounded. That makes five, and we need to stress on the loss of a contractor who was working with us, a foreigner contractor who was working inside the base camp. I need to praise those soldiers who have sacrificed their life for the stability and security development of Somalia. We need also to be to be praising their families of being so patient.
How did al-Shabaab manage to infiltrate such heavily fortified base?
That is the big question, and we are working on it. We are working on it together with the different partners and especially Somali security forces, and we will be putting some from our coordination. There will be some change for sure.
That's Colonel Ali Aden Mahmoud of the African Union mission in Somalia speaking with VOA Somali Service Harun Maruf Hassan. And we move to Kenya. The recent death of a northern white rhino in Santiago's zoo leaves only five of the rare species alive in the world. Three of them are in Kenya, including the only remaining male. Wildlife scientists are exploring ways to save the species nearly wiped out by poaching and environmental problems. Gabe Joslo reports from Nairobi.
The northern white rhino that once roamed a territory stretching from Uganda through the Democratic Republic of Congo and as far north as Chad could disappear within our lifetimes. The old Pajeta Conservancy in central Kenya is home to three of these animals. Under the watch of armed guards, they meander easily across a natural expanse of grass and shrubs and rub and play and eat with groups of southern white rhinos, their close genetic cousins. Mohamed Doyo has been caretaker to these animals since they arrived at the conservatory in 2009.
The one I'm touching here, she is called Najin, or you can call her Nai. Nai is 25 years old. Her daughter, she is 13 years old, and she is the last one born in the zoo. The other one is Sudan, the only male left in the world.
The rhinos came to Kenya from a zoo in the Czech Republic with the hope that the species would thrive in a more natural habitat. But that optimism has not been met with breeding success, and the population is dwindling fast. One of the rhinos here, Suni, unexpectedly died in October. A zoo in the U.S. city of San Diego lost another in mid-December. San Diego still has one left, as does the zoo in the Czech Republic. But the last wild population in the Democratic Republic of Congo was hunted and killed during armed conflicts in the last decade. Killings of all types of rhinos across Africa have been driven by Asian demand due to the mistaken belief that the horns have medicinal properties. Doyo files down the rhino's horns at Old Pajeta to make them less enticing to poachers. He also had a chance to lobby on behalf of the rhinos to a visiting Chinese basketball legend.
There was a guy here by the name Yao Ming. He was doing a documentary telling the China people should stop believing the horn of a rhino as a medicine. Instead of that, I told him they should use their fingernails or hair because it's one material.
Sudan, the last male of the species, is 41 years old, and his past attempts at mating were unsuccessful. So now conservationists will try to artificially impregnate a young, fertile female. If that does not work, they will try in vitro fertilization, possibly using a southern white rhino as a kind of surrogate mother. The last solution would be crossbreeding between the two species, which are physically and genetically similar. This is Richard Vine, CEO of Old Pajeta.
It's about preserving those genetic traits which confer upon the northern white as a species or a subspecies, whatever you want to call it, the ability to live in Central Africa with all of the disease and habitat challenges that that presents. Those genetic traits could be preserved as part of a hybrid with a southern white. But as long as they're there, then one day, hopefully, maybe in 100 years' time, we'll be able to reintroduce rhinos into that part of Africa.
The fact of the matter is the northern white rhino gene pool has been depleted to the point that preserving the animal as a unique species is quite a long shot. But Vine says this effort is not just about saving one type of rhino.
We're keen to make the point that, you know, if human beings continue to treat the planet in the way that they're treating it, this isn't going to be the only major mammalian species which goes extinct in the next few years. That's going to happen more and more and more.
Vine says the process is expected to get underway in January with the assistance of experts from the Czech zoo where they came from. The good news is that southern white rhino populations have rebounded in the last century since being pushed to the brink of extinction themselves. If crossbreeding is successful, then there is hope that some trace of the otherwise doomed northern white species may still live on. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Kenya.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the super classic East African song, Marina, by Sam Mapangala. This one goes out to our listeners of VOA's affiliate station, Classic FM 92.3 in Juba, VOA's 107.5 in Nairobi, and 93.5 FM in Juba.
Nikiwa nikitembea
We have been listening to a little bit of that classic by Samba Mapangala with the song Marina. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope you'll join us next week for more editions of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.